Well, good morning, everyone. It's a pleasure to be here, and thank you so much for the invitation and for all the efforts you've put into organizing this meeting. And what I'd like to talk to you about is a particular topic, the phenomenon, a model for the phenomenon of courtship feeding and nuptial gifts, and I'll show you some pictures of what that is in a minute. And then also indicate to you my approach to modeling social behavior. Now, courtship feeding occurs in both vertebrates and invertebrates, and this is an example from birds, as you can see. These are great tits here, and courtship feeding in the ornithology literature usually refers to an adult male feeding an adult female. And this occurs during ovulation quite often, and during and while the egg is in the female's body, and then after the egg is laid and through the time of up until the time of fledgling. So that's the maximum duration that the courtship feeding can occur. But it could also occur for shorter intervals of time. And this is another common example that we see in Hawaii, where this is the introduced northern cardinal, which is now widespread in Hawaii. We can see this on our porch. And this I have in here just as a lovely shot of courtship feeding in seabirds. And this also occurs in insects. And I have only one slide of insects here. These are katydids. And frequently, these are called nuptial gifts. And what's going on here is that a male will give the female a large mass. The large mass is often attached to sperm. And these are flies in which this happens as well. And the typical interpretation among entomologists is that this is a device to ensure copulation time. But there's increasing evidence, particularly from katydids, that this is copulation time in the sense that the copulation occurs during the period that the male is giving the female this food. And however, there's also increasing evidence from katydids and others that some of this material is actually incorporated into the eggs. So the interpretation typically among ornithologists is that courtship feeding is used to increase the fecundity of the female. And so by providing the female with nutrients, more eggs are laid that the female or that the male can sire. Whereas the interpretation usually for insects is that the courtship feeding is specifically to acquire the opportunity to mate. However, there's also evidence that there might be some so-called paternal investment involved here as well, in the sense that the material is incorporated into eggs and leads to higher fecundity. Now, the approach that I've been taking to modeling social behavior is indicated by this diagram, and I should perhaps begin by saying that I approached the evolution of social behavior from a background in population and community ecology. And over the last 40, 50 years, there have been a number of developments in that area of ecology, which I think would be appropriate in modeling social behavior as well. One of them is the development of models that are so-called bottom-up and or sometimes the phrase individual-based models are used. So back in the 70s, typically models in population dynamics were framed from a top-down point of view, that is, models that you may have heard of, like the logistic equation and the Lotka-Volterra equation, are stipulated a priori as applying to a population. And the problem with top-down models in ecology has been twofold. First, they're turn out to be remote from the mechanisms by which population dynamics occurs. But more importantly, Steve Smale, who's a mathematician some of you may know, showed that the predictions from Botka-Volterra-style models were not structurally stable, and that there were seriously different predictions that could be obtained from population dynamic models depending on fine details of their formulation. So this required that ecologists develop models based on the mechanism of population dynamics and based on the mechanisms of growth and reproduction directly so that they could be pretty confident about what the model was. So that's what led to the emphasis on bottom-up modeling. And the other main the main approach or strategy has been to comes from so-called life history theory, which is the theory that predicts when animals should begin breeding and how long they should live their lives. And the approach in ecology to model something like when would a plant flower, what would be the optimal time for a plant to flower, which would be a classic problem in life history theory. You start at the end of the growing season and you work backwards recursively to find out when the best time would be. So this would be a backward induction style of logic. And my approach to social behavior is the same in the sense, and I carry this with me, so that it seems to me that a profitable approach to modeling social behavior is to model the behavior itself as the first class object and work up from there to population genetics. And similarly, in discussing phenomena like mating strategies, I would begin by looking at what is necessary to produce offspring and work back to mating as setting up the social infrastructure from which offspring emerge. And both of these strategies that I take differ from the common approach in this field. Now, turning specifically to nuptial gifts and courtship feeding, I've been particularly enchanted by the area of economics called the theory of the firm. And this particularly began to flourish during the 1970s and treats a great many of the same questions that behavioral ecologists and evolutionary social behavior theorists have treated quite independently. And there have been a number of models that economists working on the theory of the firm have developed that seem to me could be imported with some changes into social behavior. And the principal agent model is one of the most elementary of the models treated in the theory of the firm. And it refers here to the principal who's the owner of a company, of a firm, and the agent who's the firm's employee. And the general problem being addressed is what the compensation should be from the principal to the agent in order to achieve an alignment of incentives, an alignment of interests. And this would be a pretty canonical model for of a principal-agent type just applied here to the question of nuptial feeding. So this would be the fitness. And by the fitness right here, I mean the daily increment of fitness increase. So if you're starting to model behavior at the behavioral level, then the problem is one of looking at behavioral actions as leading accumulated over the lifespan to the kind of fitness you'd use in a population genetic intergenerational model. So WF right here is the fitness increment, the daily increment for a female. And I'm assuming right here this is equal to the nuptial gift, and operationally I'm taking the nuptial gift as being the material the male gives to the female prior to copulation or any subsequent reproduction. And so it's a payment in advance. And C is the courtship feeding, which occurs during the copulation or the subsequent raising of the offspring. And then this is the compensation that the that the female pays the male. The female is the principal in this case. And M is the compensation rate per unit of courtship feeding. And then this is the female's outside option. And this is the fitness rate for the male, and this represents what it's being compensated for its courtship feeding. And this is an example of a cost term, how much it costs the male to go get that food. And this term is the cost of the nuptial gift. And the policy decision in this problem is for the female to decide M, the compensation rate she will supply to the male per unit of courtship feeding. And the policy decision for the male is to decide the amount of courtship feeding he should give, and possibly the nuptial gift. Now, the nuptial gift, if the nuptial gift is positive, it means that the male is giving the female something. But the nuptial gift could also be negative in the case where the female has to induce the male. That's a remote case. A real quick question, otherwise. Oh, that's the coefficient of proportionality in here, and S stands for sires. So that's the amount of sires that the male gets as a result of this compensation he's supplied. Now, just to jump to the results here, results are kind of complicated, actually. Now, first of all, if the female and the male are playing against each other, so to speak, as almost as adversaries, then you can solve for the Nash competitive equilibrium, which I'm indicating as this dot down here. And for the numerical values I was using, it happens to be that this would be the male's fitness gain, this is the female's fitness gain, and you compute the optimal degree of courtship feeding associated with this. Now, in this situation, the optimal nuptial gift would actually be zero. Now, what's interesting is that there's a different possibility altogether, which is studied in this literature. This is not original with me. The other possibility is that if you take the sum of the fitnesses of both the male and the female, you get the total excess possible. And you can solve quite easily for a degree of nuptial feeding, a degree of courtship feeding, a C, and an M, a compensation rate, which leads to a win-win solution for the male and the female. And this is where the cooperation comes in, which is, of course, the theme of this workshop. Now, you can exhibit a whole set of points in here which represent, so to speak, win-win solutions to the male and the female. And if the male, and in particular, if the male provides a nuptial gift of up to a quarter, that would provide the male, that's the maximum gift the male could give. And the minimum gift that the male could give and still come out equal to its previous point, and the maximum that the gift could give, which would boost the female's fitness the most, would be 3/8. And for the interval of points in here along this line, there are strategies of cooperation which are win-win from both points of view. And this point right here is especially interesting. This is the Nash bargaining solution, which you compute as the pair, the optimal compensation rate, the optimal M, and the optimal N, the nuptial gift, that simultaneously, so it's the pair that maximizes the product of the two fitnesses. If you form the product of the two fitnesses right here, you obtain an expression called the Nash product, and the maximization of that gives you the Nash bargaining solution. And Some of you know Nash suggested this as a good candidate for an optimal solution in a bargaining problem. And it's relative to taking the Nash competitive solution as the so-called threat point. When Nash was working on this problem, it's very interesting. He had the labor management negotiation as a case study. And in the case of the labor management negotiation, the labor can, of course, go out on strike, and management can have a lockout. Both of these represent threats. And for a threat to be credible, they actually have to do it now and then and show the opposing party that they will be willing to suffer the pain of actually incurring the threat. And in light of the threat point, then the best compromise works out to be the product of the maximum of the product of their two utilities. Now, so this is cooperation, but it's not altruism. It's definitely a kind of cooperation which is mediated by the necessity to bargain. Now, Nash left unspecified how you reach a Nash bargaining solution, and we in biology, I think, have taken it for granted that animals can't do this because there are no laws and there are no institutions and so forth. But there might very well be the emergence of what you might call biological norms of behavior or biological institutions through repeated interactions. Now, I've suggested that there are schemes of back and forth dickering around between animals which could lead to a Nash bargaining solution. But I've suggested that there's another type as well, which involves the experience of reciprocal pleasure through intimate social contact, or intimate physical contact. And here's an example right here, if you look at lots of primates, of animals that are hanging out very closely together. And actually, if you think about it, there are a great many animal species in which physically touching one another is a large part of their daily life. And one might wonder why they're doing this. It ranges from primates that you see right here, but you've probably seen birds sometimes who groom each other's feathers. You can look at parrots and find a parrot, taking its bill, running its bill through the feathers of another parrot. And then you also see all of this social interaction, physically intimate contact in sexual relations. And here's an example of two male lions. You see there, and this is a same-sex interaction right here. This was shot by a photographer from Brazil. And you see this one male mounts the other male. And if you run it again, for example, you can see that there's a friendship or an affiliation that's going in it. And so it raises the question of why are they doing this? And so I've hypothesized that all of these behaviors that involve physical intimacy represent a proximal mechanism for obtaining a Nash, something like a Nash bargaining solution. Now, furthermore, getting back to the model, there are lots of cases you can study right here which involve allowing for outside options. So neither can have an outside option. One of them can have an outside option. The male or the female could have an outside option, or both could have outside options. And I don't propose to go into these in a lot of detail. This manuscript is available online. As I gave this talk to the economics department at the University of Hawaii couple months ago, and it's available from their website as a pre-publication paper. Now, one other thing that occurs in this courtship feeding is that occasionally the courtship feeding terminates, and you might ask, what is the condition for the courtship feeding to stop? And with a fairly familiar calculation, you can go through the temptation. You can look at what the temptation to defect is, which would be, for the case of the female, receiving the nuptial gift, receiving the courtship feeding, but not paying the compensation. And she can only do that once, and if she does that once, thereafter her so-called punishment would be to have just to be able to enjoy the outside option. So she never gets any more, quote, any feeding. And the benefit to the female of continued courtship feeding is her fitness evaluated at the Nash bargaining solution with the corresponding compensation rate. Similarly, there's a condition for the male to terminate the relationship, which you can go through here. And in the usual type of computation, you calculate the expected fitness over the breeding season of the day-to-day activities. So this would be the expected fitness over the season for the female would be that if she divorces, would be to benefit from the temptation first off, but thereafter just live through the just accept the penalty payment, and as a function of L, which is the probability of living from day to day. And similarly, you can compute the probability of, or the fitness she would obtain if she lived, if she didn't defect and lived from day to day. And then you do the summation, and you compute quite simply the threshold daily survival for continued pairing. What's interesting about this is that the threshold daily survival has to be greater than the smaller, or greater than the larger of these two for the pair to consist. And the data are that the probability of a divorce gets higher and higher in species where there's a lot of mortality. And so in high mortality species, you would get more divorces and less of this courtship feeding. Now, I'd like to briefly mention a couple other points. The principal agent problem is one example from the theory of the firm, which might be useful to us. Another one that I've explored at some length comes from a theorem, some work of Groves, pertaining to incentives in a conglomerate. A conglomerate is a kind of company that has a parent holding company in it. It makes its money from subdivisions. And this suggested the analogy that the parent company is literally a parent in biology, and that the offspring might be viewed as divisions, so to speak, because the parent earns its fitness through the offspring. And so therefore, that sets up in order to have honest communication from the parent to the offspring, you can set this up as an auction. And this is following the treatment in Groves. So the parent can solicit from the offspring its so-called demand curve. And on the basis of that, the parent can set the price for food. And the price for food would be the amount of food that a parent would give the offspring per unit of offspring begging. And the begging is expensive. And so this would be the kind of result. This is an optimal demand curve right here. Horizontal axis is price, vertical axis is food quantity. And you can see the bigger, the higher the price of the food, the less food the chick will demand optimally. And taking that into account, if that's communicated to the female, to the parent, then the parent can compute the best price from its point of view. So this is the fitness of the parent as a function of the price it's charging the offspring. And the peak right here would be the optimal price. And based on that price, you would have a completed negotiation. Now, what's interesting about this is that if you let the chick have the ability to feed itself to some extent, these curves, you get a transition from having no optimum, from having an optimum to having no optimum price. I'm interpreting this as the size as indicating the weaning of the chick. So as the chick grows through time, it's these curves right here. So as the chick grows through time and increases in its ability to catch prey and to feed itself, there comes a point where it is no longer profitable for the parent to feed the offspring at all. And at that point, the weaning occurs. So from a model like this, which is very mechanism-based, you can actually predict when the bird should be fledged. And then what do you do with models like this? Well, in principle, as I mentioned before, what you do is you take the day-to-day fitnesses and you add them up and you get the lifetime fitnesses, and then you plug the lifetime fitnesses into a population genetic model which operates between generations. So we're going from a behavioral tier to an evolutionary tier, if you will. And this is an example of a model of that genre that Errol Ace and I published. This, for example, imagines that there is one locus and two alleles in a genetic system, and that if the A2 allele is fixed, the animals are playing a game with this payoff matrix, and then you can compute that there's some kind of nice results here. You can compute the conditions under which the A2 allele is replaced by the A1 allele, which has a different payoff matrix. And in this way, you can study, in a population genetic way, the evolution of the payoff matrix. And so you don't have to take, and in my opinion, should not take, for evolutionary reasoning, the game itself as being fixed, but the game itself should evolve. And so we would, in my group's approach to modeling social behavior, we would model the social behavior and let the parameters of the social game evolve at a higher tier like this. And finally, I'm shameless enough to give you a commercial. This is my first book as I began looking into social behavior. It's called Evolution's Rainbow, and it's now translated into Portuguese in Brazil and into Korean. And my most recent book, The Genial Gene, is also now translated into French. So thank you very much.
Thank you very much, Joan. So do we have any questions? Yes, David.
Yeah, right.
What about the stability of?
Well, of course, it depends if the noise enters linearly or nonlinearly, and so it depends on the details. Actually, the way that economists usually write this model down is by including noise in the very beginning. And there, a lot of the discussion among economists has to do with knowledge and with what the parties know about one another. And that's often taken as a random variable. In the framing that I've given, I've actually taken that out because I didn't think it added anything. You wound up getting expectations that were the same as deterministic variables. And I think it would take a more subtle use of noise to get the results being changed relative to the framing that economists have. And I have to say my own inclination is to make the model as simple as possible and not to put in extra generality that you don't actually use. And that's why I stripped out a lot of the linear noise from a model where the expectations were the same as the deterministic result. Yeah, well, there wasn't any. Well, that would matter, sure. But then that's not what was in the economist framing either. So we would, so we'd have to really work on that. And shall I answer a question? Yeah, go ahead. Are you calling the people in line?
Yeah.
Okay.
Thank you. I'm just curious what you think is the best way to test these models in a very precise way, in the sense of what class of organisms, how low in the evolutionary history we should go, where it's possible to make a graph of, you know, experimental observation versus some control parameter that you can twiddle. So is it something where we can do genetic modifications to a class of organisms and look for changes and then compare to this kind of model? What's the best way to proceed?
That would work. That is to say, looking at mutations and developing an array of different behavioral types and then seeing how they function. That might be quite expensive, though. And I think given the state of knowledge in this, a lot of the testing can be done comparatively. There are very clear qualitative predictions that come out of the proposition that the nuptial gifts and courtship feeding represents a competitive solution versus a cooperative solution. Now, one can basically inspect qualitatively whether those different situations occur. As you know, we don't have a large history in biology of understanding cooperation, hence the reason for a conference like this. We've been raised with how to think about competition. We know a lot about how to think about competition, and so we don't often even have good experimental designs to detect cooperation. So I don't see in these evolutionary arguments, in these evolutionary models, yet the chance to make, as you put it, precise predictions, quantitatively precise predictions. And I'm not sure the field wants that. And if I can digress just a second, when I used to be working in marine ecology, we developed population models for barnacles along the California coast here. And barnacles, it happens, have a larval phase that goes out of the ocean and then comes back to shore. And we worked out a model for the general picture of that, and then we got more and more refined so that we could actually make quantitative predictions of the amount of barnacles that could be on a rock, taking into account data from buoys and from satellites and so on to know what the state of the ocean was. And the reviews we began to get were that this was overkill, that people really weren't interested in the holy grail of quantitative predictions from models to data. And that is still my picture of the biological peer group in this area. I'm not sure the demand for quantitative predictions comes from biologists. It tends to come from theoreticians, or sometimes from physicists, if I might. But I'm not sure it's really there. Most biologists are interested in getting the qualitative story right. And it's not often that desire is satisfied with quantitative prediction, with quantitative accuracy.
If I could just follow up on that. So, for instance, maybe it's a two-part question that might have the same answer, which is, what's the most primitive organism that you would think displays this kind of behavior? And is it sufficiently simple that it's amenable to genetic modification?
All these insects would certainly be genetically amenable. But it's funny, when I talk with yeast biologists, for example, I often talk to microbial biologists, microbiologists, and they accuse me of being a vertebrate chauvinist, which I am, because the species I work on the most are lizards. And say that, well, yeast can do this, you know, and okay. And of course, if they can, then wow, there's an incredible experimental feasibility possible.
Thank you.
Yeah.
I guess I could ask if there's a gene for courtship.
Maybe. All set.
Any more questions?
Great.
Here's a microphone. So one of the challenges that I find just in conceptualizing and integrating this framework into my own framework as an evolutionary geneticist is trying to understand how our notion of conflicts of interest that arise due to differing asymmetries and patterns of relatedness can be incorporated into these kinds of models, so that the conflicts that there's an accounting for of the sort of differences in efficiency, if you will, of transmission of the genes that might underlie these behaviors and conflicts of interest that might emerge from those relatedness asymmetries.
Well,
how does kin selection
fit? Okay, kin selection in particular affects, I think, the costs, the relative prices you would charge. So if we go ahead to this one, where there's much more chance for conflict. Suppose there are two offspring here, or three offspring, in a more complicated conglomerate. Well, then the demand curve and the price for food, these curves right here, wind up being dependent on the coefficient of genetic relationship between the parent and the various offspring, and the various offspring with one another. So the kinship and relatedness is definitely important, but it's not a driver in this kind of approach. It's a factor that you need to consider in the quantitative study of the pricing. So there's definitely conflict. But as you know, we've been raised to think about conflict. Conflict is in our blood, if you will, in thinking about how animals interact, how genes interact, and so on. And I think where, I don't mean to pontificate here, but just where we need more experience is in intuiting how cooperation forms, what's in it for both parties to cooperate. And when we get a better intuition for that, we'll know how to look for it and know how to have a better perspective on how much conflict goes on versus how much cooperation goes on. Because conflict is not conflict, that is to say, is not the default case. Now, fitness advantage might be the default case. We would take that as given. But fitness advantage doesn't require conflict. And so therefore, as we get more experience with what situations cooperation underlies fitness advantage versus conflict, then I think we'll get a more balanced view of that.
Yeah. One more question, very quick.
Can we not sort of, okay, first thing, I think we can be pluralist about explanations here, so we don't need to have one explanation claimed to be the only explanation we can give. And I think the inclusive fitness school can give an explanation in terms of the fitness advantage to both parents, both of whom are have the same relatedness to the offspring. So there'll be a cost to the male to providing the food, but presumably that increases the fecundity of the female, and therefore of his own fecundity by, uh-huh. you know, because they're both equally related. But of course, he's got a opportunity to mate elsewhere as well, perhaps depending on the life history of this particular organism. And so you could probably frame an optimization problem in those terms as well, and solve for, you know, for the optimum. Is that the kind of thing, Richard, you're talking about?
Yeah. I don't disagree with that, though. But the problem is that I think we need more than that approach. There are mm-hmm. two issues I would raise with the sort of modeling strategy you've just laid out right there. One is that it would tend to be top-down. It would tend to require as a solution concept the ESS from Maynard Smith. Mm-hmm. And that, in my view, is basically a top-down solution concept. It involves attaching strategies to genes and then looking at conditions under which you get a genetic equilibrium. And then from that, you're supposed to trickle down into what the behavior should look like. And I'm finding that the same objections to that logic that we've already encountered in population ecology also occur here. And I think that strategy leads to predictions that are remote from the phenomena, and so that the behavior then is a second-class object rather than a first-class object. And then also, I think that the ESS solution concept is not the only concept we should be considering when it comes to behavior. Because while gene pool dynamics may equilibrate at an ESS, it's not clear that behavioral dynamics obey the same constraint, because you very well could have the evolution of behavioral mechanisms that culminate in different solutions other than the Nash competitive equilibrium, namely the Nash bargaining solution. And then there are multi-strategy type extensions of those. So that would be my problem with this strategy that you laid out. It has nothing to do with having any objections to taking relatedness into account. It has to do with whether we should really be doing the modeling bottom up rather than top down, and whether the ESS concept is sufficient for studying behavioral games.
Thank you.
Okay, thank you very much, Joan.